Well, we're going from oil and gas to mining. Some of you all remember last year, we had one person that didn't make it. She says she was stuck in snow in Seattle, I think, but we're really pleased that she's here today. Diantha Crockett is the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association, a professional trade association representing Alaska's large mines and projects, small placer mines and businesses, and individuals that support Alaska's mining industry. She serves on the Executive Committee of the Armed Forces YMCA of Alaska, and is active in the Alaska Resource Education Program. She enjoys running her chocolate lab, Hank, and we hope to see her back during the summer. So, Diantha Crockett.
So I'd almost forgotten about that, Tim. It's been a year ago, and I will extend another apology a year later. I was mortified when I had to call Tim, and I was stuck in Portland during a snowstorm with people that don't know how to handle snowstorms, apparently, because we drove fine through it. I was bringing Hank back from my parents' house in Texas to Alaska at the time, and we were stuck there in an airport for 3 days, and it was a complete nightmare. I would have rather been here with you, so thank you very much for both of your kind understanding at the time and for inviting me back. Very happy to be here. So a bit about AMA before I begin. We're a professional membership-funded trade association that represents the mining industry in Alaska from an umbrella perspective. We've been around since 1939, and today we have about 1,400 members. We've got 8 statewide branches, including right here in Kenai, and from as far south as the Ketchikan, Prince of Wales Island area, and as far north as Nome. So we do have an extensive reach across Alaska. Our members consist of small-scale placer mines, many of them which are family-owned and very small, large-scale metal mines and projects, coal mines, industrial minerals like sand and gravel and quarry rock, and then the contractors in the business sector that support our industry, many of whom are located down here on the peninsula. So a quick overview on what I plan to discuss with you today. To get started, I'll discuss the purpose of mining, both in Alaska and beyond. I'll give an overview of the current operations, projects, and prospects around Alaska. I'll showcase the economic benefits resulting from mining activity in our state, and I'll discuss the regulatory process that protects our environment here. I'll review the opportunities to grow our industry, and I'll plan to leave plenty of time for questions, but I don't mind in the least if you ask them along the way. So before I begin with in-depth mining information, I simply have to share this because I think it's critically important. Mining takes place all over the world to supply a demand for minerals and mine products that each human has a dependency on and a relationship with. So for example, here we have the mineral baby. Each year, the Minerals Education Coalition does an extensive study of minerals consumption and publishes the mineral baby to give a sample of what every human being born today will have to consume in their lifetimes. And they're not insignificant numbers. You can see there's, you probably can't see actually, but there's 971 pounds of copper, 521 pounds of zinc, 459,000 pounds of copper is what each and every one of us is going to need over the course of our lifetimes to do all the things that we do. And this is just an example of about the 15 minerals that this place studies to determine what our dependency is on minerals. So to put that into a perspective of things you actually care about, it's likely a safe assumption that every one of you has some sort of phone, whether it's smart or otherwise, with you today, and you're generally glued to it. And whether we want to admit it or not, we're very dependent on our devices. So here's an example of the minerals that are found in Alaska that go into an iPhone. And I have to say, I know this is like 5 iPhone models ago, and I'll get to work on a new graphic, but I did ask around and do some homework on this, and I'm told that with the increase in technology of the iPhone and the increase of the size of the iPhone, the minerals has actually increased in each one of these. So more importantly, minerals are a part of the things that I hope you never have to use. This is an incredibly boring photo, I get it, and it shows a guardrail, of course, but the reason I put this in here is because this guardrail is actually galvanized by zinc to keep the structural integrity of a guardrail together. So the reason that a guardrail keeps a car on the road is because of zinc. Zinc plays a very vital part in our lives in a number of other ways. Some other examples of vital uses of minerals is gold is actually the most important component of the airbag in your car. It prevents corrosion and makes sure that the airbag actually deploys. And silver is actually used on burn victims in emergency rooms to control infection. So minerals are also a very important part of our quest for renewable energy. And of course, this is the Fire Island Wind Farm outside of Anchorage. And these are the minerals that go into a standard wind turbine made across the world. Minerals are also vital components of hybrid vehicles, solar panels, et cetera. So I really just had to hammer that point home because clearly every one of us doesn't only need, but we actually depend on and want minerals for use in our everyday lives. So with this demand, we know the extraction of minerals is going to continue to take place somewhere in this world. We know that it's critically important to connect our dependency on minerals with the actual industry's existence. With constantly evolving technologies, we know that the demand will increase, and therefore the operations worldwide that supply these minerals are going to increase. So let's see what Alaska's mines are doing to supply the demand for minerals around the world. The Red Dog Mine is the world's largest zinc concentrate producer. This is located in the northwest part of Alaska near Kotzebue. It's the economic engine of Northwest Alaska. It's the only taxpayer in the Northwest Arctic Borough. It employs about 600 people, a large portion of which are Alaska Native and Nana Regional Corporation shareholders. The Fort Knox Mine in Fairbanks is our largest producing gold mine. It's got 100% Alaska resident hire, and each of its 660 employees actually goes home to their home in Fairbanks at the end of their shift. Late last year, Fort Knox acquired leases to neighboring property where they knew the deposit was headed, which is great. It was great news because it allows them to extend the mine life of this operation, which is the Fairbanks North Star Borough's largest single property taxpayer. Pogo is an underground gold mine near Delta Junction. It's our only mine located on State of Alaska-owned land primarily, which is important because it increases the mine's contributions to the State of Alaska revenues. Pogo's got over 300 employees, and it's in an unincorporated area, but the mine has an agreement with the city of Delta Junction for an annual contribution. The Yusubeli Coal Mine has been in operation for 75 years, immediately adjacent to Denali National Park. The mine's been family-owned this entire time and has performed reclamation long before it was required by law, so this mine has continuously reclaimed the land as it mines for many, many years. It has about 110 employees, based out of the interior, and it's a significant taxpayer in the Denali borough. The Kensington Underground Gold Mine is located about 45 miles northwest of Juneau. It recently completed its seventh year of production, following which many of you will remember a pretty extensive litigation of its mine plan that ended up at the United States Supreme Court. Coeur, the company that owns Kensington, ultimately did prevail, which was great news, of course, for the city and borough of Juneau, where it's the second largest private employer in the city and borough of Juneau. And the Greens Creek Mine, located on Admiralty Island within the Admiralty Island National Monument, so wilderness. It's about 18 miles south of Juneau. It's been operating since 1989, and it's one of the world's top 10 silver producers. It is the largest private employer in Juneau with 420 employees. And between Kensington, the mine I just showed you, and Greens Creek, it is the Juneau's largest mining tax. Mining is Juneau's largest taxpayer. Excuse me. So finally, we have our seventh large mine. Alaska's placer mines account for as many jobs and revenues to the state and procurement as any of single one of our large mines or any of the single large proposed mines in on our horizon. Placer mines provide for about 1,200 direct, so that's in the mine, mostly seasonal jobs, which has a 75% Alaska resident hire rate. And the majority of that 75% are actually not residents of Anchorage, Mat-Su, or Fairbanks, so not residents of our three largest cities, including a lot of residents that are down here on the peninsula. On average, each of our placer mines has about four workers, but 27% of them actually only have one person. That's one person doing the mining, doing the payroll to themselves, doing the permitting for the environmental work, everything, just a one-man band. And so it's really impressive to see some of these guys in action. And then we've got a handful of significant larger placer operations that have 50 or more employees. Nearly half, so about 47% of our active placer mining operations in Alaska, this is just a fun fact, this is not totally useful, but it's a fun fact, they have at least one family member on their payroll. So we really do mean on our bumper stickers when we say mining is the family farm of the North. So you can see the large operating mines I've just covered depicted by the black stars on the map, and then the circle triangle icons represent advanced exploration projects that we hope to see turn into stars in the future. So you can see they have a pretty far reach from all the way up near Kotzebue, all the way down on the Aleutians, and all the way down in southern southeast Alaska. And what we mean when we say advanced exploration project is a project that is either in permitting now, expected to enter into permitting soon, or has done a great deal of environmental studies, engineering, planning, et cetera, so that they could get into permitting in the future. So something that we hope to see being developed and operating in our near future, and not just early on exploration of a potential deposit. So I'd like to hone in on two of these west of us, as they've both got some exciting news to share right now. So the Donlin Gold Project in Southwest Alaska, after more than 6 years, the permitting process for this project is finally nearing the end. The final permitting documents were completed by the lead federal agency, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, in July, so just about 6 months ago. And following review by the other involved agencies, expects to publish the final document early this year and then issue a final record of decision this summer. Once the record of decision and major permits are issued, the two companies that equally own this project will decide whether or not to construct it. The Donlin Gold Project is estimated at more than 33 million ounces, and if developed, it would provide jobs in the Yukon-Kuskokwim region for 27 years or more. And following many years of litigation with EPA regarding its actions to preemptively restrict and veto the Pebble Project, and last year, Pebble and EPA entered into an agreement in which Pebble would put forth a permitting application and EPA would cease the litigation against the project. So in late December, Pebble did submit a project to the Army Corps of Engineers, which on January 5th was accepted. So this initiates the formal permitting process for the Pebble project. This initiates the process in which we can review what the company is proposing to do and starts the public input process, et cetera. The mine also recently released a significantly revised mine plan as part of this process with a smaller footprint and different environmental proposals. And if built, Pebble would employ 2,000 workers during its 4-year construction phase and 850 workers during its 20-year mine life. And both Pebble and Donlin have proposed pretty extensive natural gas pipelines from the Cook Inlet area. So I'd like to quickly touch on the economic benefits that Alaska sees from the mining industry. And you can see them on the screen, pretty impressive. So there's 4,000 direct that's in the mine jobs and 8,600 direct and indirect jobs. Pretty significant payroll numbers, with our average wage being $108,000 a year. That's more than twice the state's average wage, and very, very good, particularly because a lot of these employees are residents of over 50 communities in Alaska, a large portion of which are located in rural areas where there's not a great deal of other employment opportunities. Excuse me. And in addition, these mines have significant procurement benefits where we're actually in the middle of. I kind of wish I was speaking to you a month later, because we're almost wrapping up. McDowell is doing a study for us that we do every 5 years to extensively understand our benefit to Alaska-based businesses. But the last time we did this 5 years ago, the number was $500 million to Alaska-based businesses that contract or support our mines. So it's very, very impressive and significant procurement numbers. There's also pretty significant benefits to Alaska Native corporations. Through ANCSA's 7I and 7J royalty sharing program, to date, over $1 billion has been distributed to Nana Regional Corporation from the Red Dog Mine. Of that $1.3 billion, $860 million was then distributed from Nana to other village and regional corporations in every corner of the state. So the benefits of mining on Native corporation land do not exclusively stay in that region. They are distributed through the ANCSA royalty sharing provisions. $2 million went to Calista in 2016. That's just in 1 year from the Donlin operation. And that's, of course, before Donlin actually is making money and is in operation. And that's just the agreement as part of ANCSA there. There's also impressive jobs for shareholders. I mentioned earlier that Red Dog had an impressive Nana shareholder rate, higher rate. That's 58%. And the Upper Kobuk Minerals Project is the other advanced exploration project on Nana land, has a 44% shareholder higher rate. So great things happening for residents of those regions. So getting to permitting and regulatory oversight of mining. This here is a slide that was actually created by the Department of Natural Resources. I stole it a few years ago. I admitted to them I stole it. And I continue to use it because it demonstrates, first of all, that it's from the agencies. The agencies put this together to demonstrate that there's not one single permit to mine. This is not a rubber stamp process. It's not easy to permit a mine. And it takes years of planning an environmental review and testing. And the approval process from to permit a large mine in Alaska is pretty extensive. One of the most important things that I would hope to impress upon you today about permitting a mine in Alaska is that this process doesn't guarantee approval. It does not guarantee approval. Every mine is different. It requires a tailor-made plan, and it's discussed pretty lengthy, and which is why it takes so long, by the permitting agencies and by the developer. And throughout that process, there's multiple opportunities for public participation. In many cases, can change the outcome of the mine. So the permits on this screen, they're listed here for basically what's typical for a mine that's either on privately held or state land. Still, a large amount of federal authorizations required, but if there was a mine that was permitted on federally owned land, there's a myriad of additional permits, such as BLM and Forest Service permits that are not listed on here. And finally, I guess the last thing I could say about this is that permits contain multiple stipulations that every permit has to comply with statutes and regulations in our state. However, there's a lot of permit stipulations that are well outside our governing laws that prescribe the mines to do additional practices that the agency would like to see happening there. So a lot of times mines can and they do go way above and beyond their permit requirements. So mines, as I mentioned, are under strict regulatory oversight throughout permitting and operation, but it doesn't stop when the mine shuts down. In fact, mines have to actually have their reclamation plan approved by the Commissioner of Natural Resources before they are allowed to begin operation. Our law requires that the DNR Commissioner review it and ensure that the mine can be returned to a stable condition that's compatible with post-mining practices. And in addition to being required to obtain that approval, mines have to provide financial assurance in the event reclamation obligations can't be performed. Requirements, they apply to all companies, regardless of where they're headquartered, and they apply to all mines, no matter what kind of land ownership they're on. So any mine in Alaska has a financial assurance agreement with our agencies. The financial assurance guarantees are reviewed every 5 years at a minimum. They'll be reviewed more frequently if necessary. And we've got a system that's unique to Alaska. We've got third-party reviewers that actually review financial assurance guarantees between the mine and the state, but they actually also review the agencies that regulate mines. Alaska is the only state that does this, and it really is a very robust system that is one that we should all be proud of and take comfort in. Fish pictures. I just want to zero in on one permitting and environmental issue in particular. I know that water quality and healthy fish habitat is critically important to everyone in Alaska. I think it's an understatement for those of you that are sitting before me right now. I want to tell you that it's critically important to miners too, and there's two really good reasons for it. One being that it's the law, but the other is that miners are people like me. They're people that were born and raised here who love living here, we live here because we like to do things like this. We live here because it's beautiful, because it's a great place to be, and it's because of our environment. So it's a mentality that we take to work every single day, and we want to make sure that it remains the place that we love to play in addition to work. So how we ensure it remains that way is we work with the scientific experts at the permitting agencies to follow the laws and regulations. So all development, the mines I represent, but also wastewater treatment plants, roads, bridges, airports, they all have to follow regulations that address fish habitat and obtain the applicable permits if the development will encounter any sort of fish. So here's kind of a rundown of how that works. It's very, it's an oversimplified explanation, but here's how any development, regardless of what's being proposed, will work when it comes to encountering fish. So there have been some that attack the state's ability to manage our waters, and I appreciate Kara's explanation of the Fish Habitat Initiative, because that is just one example, in addition to some other mechanisms to designate wilderness waters or to reserve amounts of water in a stream. There are a lot of tools in which those that simply oppose development want to use to oppose development under the guise that fish is not adequately protected. But in a lot of these conversations, our own Department of Fish and Game has been called upon to answer whether inadequacies in the fish habitat and water quality process exist. And each time they have said no. They have defended their processes with success stories. And to go a little bit further, the critics of the state's regulatory agencies and the process altogether have not been able to state an existing inadequacy or an existing issue out there. So I feel like I really need to hammer this home that it's not just DEANTHA from the Miners Association telling you this. There are regulators that are with the state today who have said we do not have inadequacies and insufficiencies in our permitting process. There are not examples and case studies in which you can say that fish are being impacted by resource development. So with that regulatory process, we do see major successes, and I'd love to just share a few with you today. These here are photos that are taken of some above and beyond restoration that the Fort Knox mine near Fairbanks performed. There was some historical placer mining before 1900 in the neighboring vicinity next to the mine that left a landscape of sort of exposed permafrost and gravel pit looking isolated pond type things. And although it wasn't an area that Fort Knox operated in, they joined with the Department of Fish and Game to rehabilitate the area. So they constructed stream channels to connect the ponds, which you can see in the upper right photo, and that allowed for the fish passage between the ponds. And the activity, it ended up diversifying the vegetation from the mainly black spruce that you can see on the hillside to a lot more willows and shrubs, which, as you can see, the moose love. So this area resulted in a fish and wildlife sanctuary with prize-sized fish, which you can see the Department of Fish and Game gentleman holding up there on the top left. And at the time of performing this, the Department of Fish and Game estimated they would reach their target quantity and size of fish by the time the mine closed, and they reached it in 2 years. So Fish and Game and Fort Knox jointly received environmental awards for this work. So shown here, excuse me, I hope I'm not getting sick. Shown here is a side-by-side comparison of Red Dog Creek prior to the mining operation opening in 1989. So note in the pre-mining photo on the left, there's all this red staining from the naturally occurring mineralization at the surface. This is prior to any mining development in the area, and there's a lot more sandbars and lack of vegetation there. In the right photo, it's difficult. You can't even see the creek. I know you can see the road, but you can barely even see the creek. It's to the left of the road if you look closely, and you can't see the creek because the vegetation has grown substantially due to the cleaned up water source, which has allowed the plants to thrive. So looking at that from a regulatory perspective, here you can see the water quality results that were reported to EPA. These are just the zinc levels, again, that were naturally occurring at this site long before mining took place. So before mining, you can see it's quite high, and then the mining results reported once water treatment was being conducted at the site. So now there are species like Arctic grayling and Dolly Varden that have been really flourishing in the creek. So my last story share is the recently completed fish passage by the Greens Creek Mine in Southeast. Greens Creek has also been operating since 1989, and in its proposal for its environmental footprint, they proposed constructing salmon habitat that was previously inaccessible based on the elevation that was done there. So they constructed this, and in fact, they had a change in mine plan where their footprint was actually taken down to about half an acre, but they honored their commitment in their mine proposal, and they constructed this and monitored over time and saw the numbers of fish that were greatly increasing and getting to reach higher class habitat about 3 miles north. So they monitored it all throughout the 2000s, found a growing fish population, and in 2005, a pretty intense storm event wiped all of this out. So they set out to reconstruct it in 2016, and just to bring up a couple of things here, Admiralty Island, again, is in a national monument. You can't drive, you can't put in a road in, so they had to do all of this by hand and only materials that could be slung in by helicopter. And so here's what that fish pass looks like today. So in closing, I want to say that our future is bright. I represent an industry full of doomsdayers. I'll be the first to tell you, this guy is always falling in the mining industry, but we do have a lot to be optimistic about. We're growing, and we can see on the horizon opportunities to continue to grow our industry in the state of Alaska. Avoiding the political discussion as much as possible, and my friend Kara put this very well, we do have a pro-business federal administration, and I can say unequivocally that President Trump and the officials he has chosen to appoint, like Joe Balash, combined with our congressional delegation, has really breathed life back into our industry. We've seen this over the past year. We've seen a new confidence in investment in Alaska, and it's been very refreshing, I'll be perfectly honest with you all. We have a governor who stated many times he'd like to double the amount of mines in Alaska. I quote, he spoke to the Resource Development Council in November and said, we've got 6 large-scale mines in Alaska and we want to have 12. And so we intend to work closely with the administration to educate them on what it will take to make that a reality. And after a 4-year depression, we've seen an increase in mineral prices that has allowed for financial stability and increased appetite in investment in Alaska. So, and last I'll say is, I hammered this at the beginning and I'll do it at the end, the world needs minerals and our activity is still gonna be needed. So with that, I'm gonna thank you again for the second invitation, Tim, to come back. I really appreciate the opportunity and happy to answer any questions if there's time.
Thank you, Deantha. Hopefully next year you can come back and tell us about that 5-year study. Yeah. And several of you asked me at lunchtime whether she was going to talk at all about the Resource One project, which is the graphite project that a lot of you probably know about that we've been involved with. I actually had discussions with Ada at the end of last week, and there still has been no decision as far as where they're going to do their processing. So we still have 3 communities out of the 4 in Alaska that are being considered. So 3 of them are here on the Kenai Peninsula, but we don't have an answer. And Ada was saying that, who knows, it may be 90 days, it may be a little bit longer than that. But as soon as we have an answer, I promise I will get to you.